وبارك على سيدنا محمد وعلى آل سيدنا محمد كما باركت على سيدنا إبراهيم وعلى آل سيدنا إبراهيم في العالمين إنك حميد مجيد. الحمد لله، نحمد الله سبحانه وتعالى ونشكره ونستعينه ونستغفره ونعوذ بالله من سيئات أعمالنا. الحمد لله. I'm hoping I'll put Alhamdulillah, I really extend my gratitude to everybody. I've been to Malaysia 3 times, and the courtesy of the culture is really quite overwhelming. I'm coming from a culture that in many ways has lost their a lot of those traditions. It's really for me a great blessing to see a culture like yours. I appreciate greatly the intelligence of the women and the strength of the women. I think it's a sign of health in this culture. One of our great teachers in the United States was Madhik Shabazz, who's better known sometimes as Malcolm X. But he has a remark about the vibrancy of a culture. Is determined by the strength of the women of the culture, and so it's really I think very heartwarming to see so many active women that that are forthright, forthcoming, and I've seen some really wonderful things since I've been here, and appreciate greatly these different organizations. Dr. Azam has really been with me the whole time in each of these places. I see him and some of the other people also. I know a few people came from Australia. I don't know if they're going to get this online. We have technical problems. And I know that Malaysia is a high-tech country. So... while I'm waiting for them to get up the presentation, because I really haven't, I mean I can talk about it, but I'd rather not. But while they're doing that, this on? Is it on? Not on. And so while I'm waiting for them to resolve the problem, there's a couple of things that I would really like to emphasize, and I've emphasized this at different places. I think it's very important that you recognize the dangers that versions of Islam from outside. My own teacher, Sheikh Abdullah bin Bayya, wrote an article in his Fatawa al-Fikriya, a book that he wrote, which are intellectual fatwas, is what it was entitled. But he wrote an article, Ayu Islam and Nuri, which Islam do we want? And what's important to remember is that the Islam of Malaysia is actually much closer, in my estimation, is much closer to the spirit of true Islam than most of the Muslim countries that I've visited. And I know that Dr. Kanali can testify to the fact that it wasn't that long ago that Afghanistan was very similar, and many other places in the Muslim world. But certain ideologies have come in to many places in the Muslim world, created divisions amongst the Muslims, separated the Muslims, attacked their classical understandings of their own religion, and created major problems. Some of the songs that were just sung right now, according to some people, would be considered shirk. And this is a real problem, because these songs have been sung, and similar songs have been sung for centuries. And scholars never considered them to be examples of shirk. They understood them to be perfectly acceptable. But there are certain people that have very narrow definitions of Islam. And if you allow these ideas to permeate your culture, then I think it's going to threaten the integrity of your culture. I think it's going to threaten the unity of your culture. And it will also threaten the Malaysians that do not adhere to the religion of Islam, which is, I think, already there's some unease among some of the minority communities, and this would be a very dangerous outcome. And I think the single most dangerous aspect of it is, even though sometimes it will present itself as a kinder, gentler version, there are inherent doctrines within some of these ideologies that by their very nature lead to a type of violent extremism. So for instance, there's an idea that some of these groups espouse called Tawheed al-Hakamiya, which means that if you're not implementing the Sharia, and it's always according to their version of the Sharia, if you're not implementing the Sharia, then you're outside of Islam. And this is where you get takfir of the rulers of the Muslim world. And this is very, very dangerous. And then what happens is the ulama that are associated with the state become ulama sultan, and nobody listens to them, despite the fact that they have years of training and they actually understand the religion. And so a young person who becomes zealous and becomes victim of this type of ideology will suddenly be calling a person who's had 20 years of training, memorizes the whole Quran, knows the asbab al-nuzul, knows the tafsir, knows maqasid al-sharia, and he won't listen to him because he's just Adam Sultan. This is a real problem, and I think you need to seriously think about the spread of this ideology before it gets out of hand. And this is my warning to you, because I've seen the effects of this ideology in many countries. Libya is suffering from it, Algeria is suffering from it, and I think Sheikh Zubair, who's here from Algeria, can tell you about the experience of the Algerians in the 1990s, where you had these insane groups that were actually killing Christians, killing the monks that had been living in the desert, not bothering anybody for a long time, these poor Trappist monks that were just killed. We now have Yazidis who, the mythology is that they're devil worshippers. It's a very bizarre amalgam of Christianity, of Islam, and some of the Manichaean and Gnostic traditions that existed there. They're definitely a very unusual and strange religious phenomenon, but they have been living there for centuries, and the Muslims tolerated them because Islam is a tolerant religion. And we have many examples of heretics that lived to ripe old ages, like Abu Ala al-Ma'arri, who lived into his 80s in Halab, despite the fact that really, technically, if you read his poetry, there's heresy in his poetry. But I think the Arabs figured anybody that could write poetry that well deserved to have a long, ripe life, if he could. But that's not the point. The point is that these ideas are very, very dangerous. And don't underestimate the power of them, because they're very simplistic ideas, and common people are seduced by them. And also because the Muslim world has so much trauma right now, and there's so many problems in the Muslim world, that demagogues tend to flourish in these type of environments. And so it's very important that the trained du'at in this country, with hikmah, with wisdom, address these problems intelligently, and you need to upgrade the overall thaqafa amma, which is the general domain knowledge of the average Malay Muslims, to give them antibodies against some of these ideas, so that they actually have intellectual antibodies, and so when the ideas are presented to them, they know clearly that they're wrong. But and then another thing I would argue is that the traditionalist camp also has to recognize that they need to have an airtight Islam. So they need to also look at their own traditions. And those traditions that are valid Urfi traditions obviously can be accommodated. But if you're doing religious traditions that don't have strong dalils, it's better to give up those traditions for the sake of greater unity. And this is something I think the traditionalists need to remember. The people of Tasawwuf historically had reformers. Ahmed Sirhindi is one of the great reformers of Tasawwuf, the Mujaddid al-Thani. Also, Ahmed Zarruq was a great reformer within the tradition of Sufism. So a blanket Sufism is not always acceptable. There are problems within Sufic tradition. And even the Sufis differ within their own tradition about things. But historically, Tasawwuf was always recognized as an important component in Islam. Not necessarily the turuq and the ways that Tasawwuf sometimes was formally institutionalized, but the idea of tazkiyah, the idea of ihsan, the idea of mahabba, these were very important concepts in all of the Muslim civilizations. And if you lose these concepts, then Islam can very often become a cruel thing. And it's not a cruel thing. It's a gentle thing. And the Malay people and the Malaysian people, this is a gentle culture. It's a culture of civility. And the fundamental, if you want to really get to a fundamental definition of civilization, the definition of a civilization is when language is the way we fight. We fight with language. That is what civilization is. It's recognizing that we're going to have differences, but the weapons we use to challenge each other are the weapons of language. And we use persuasion, we use logic, we use intellect to make our arguments. And this is what every court of law recognizes. The lawyer presents the case, and the case is decided based on the prosecution and based on the defense, on who presents the more persuasive argument. And we are a tradition of law and order. This is the Islamic tradition. We have now Muslims that are beheading people out of revenge. It's just vengeance. It has nothing to do with Islamic law or Sharia. This is a disgraceful, it's just a disgraceful betrayal of everything about this tradition. And Ibn Qayyim, I read the last night a very nice article, an introductory article, which I hope is in Malay and more people read it. But it was written by Dr. Kamali, and one of the things that he presented was the idea of if you get down to the essential maqasid of the Islamic tradition, really just boil it down to the most essential elements that make up this tradition, he argued that it was rahmah and huda. It was mercy and guidance. The Prophet was sent as a hadi, as a guide, and he was sent as a rahmah. وَمَا أَرْسَلْنَاكَ إِلَّا رَحْمَةً لِلْعَالَمِينَ We only sent you as a mercy to all the worlds. Not just to, he was sent as a mercy to the bees. He was sent as a mercy to the frogs. He was sent as a mercy to the trees. And in Al-Bukhari he says al-mustarihu wal-mustarahu minhu, the one that gets repose and the one others get repose from him. And they said, who are these, O Messenger of God? And he said, the one that gets repose is the one, the believer who does good deeds, who dies and is freed of the fatigue, the exhaustion of this world. أَرْتَاحَ مِن نَصِبِ الدُّنْيَا إِلَىٰ رَحْمَةِ اللَّهِ. And then he said that the مُسْتَرَاح مِنْهُ was الْعَبْدُ الْفَاجِرُ, the profligate servant who rebels against God's order, and from him he said العباد والبلاد والشجر والدواب, the lands, the countries, the slaves, the countries, the trees, and the animals get repose from him. In other words, that his death is a blessing for even the animals. And this is why the whale in the ocean does istighfar in its own language for a righteous servant who teaches people good. This is really important to remember. Ibn Qayyim al-Jawziyah, I would add to that. Ibn Qayyim al-Jawziyah, rahimahullah, mentioned, I think, such a profound summation of Islam. There are beautiful summations, and Dr. Kamali's is an excellent one, of Rahman Huda. Fakhruddin al-Razi and Imam al-Ghazali also, and others, argued that all of Islam could be reduced to two fundamental concepts: the service of the Creator and service of His creation. عبادة الخالق وخدمة الخلق, right? Or رحمة إلى الخلق. So to serve the Creator with guidance and to show compassion and mercy to His creation. And this includes the Jew, the Christian, the Buddhist, the fire worshiper. All of them are guests of God. They're all guests of God. God created all of them. He created all of them for a hikmah. And He said, had He wanted, He would have made us all one ummah. But He didn't. He made us different. We differ. And we have different a'raf. We have different norms and different traditions. And one of the beauties of our religion is Islam acknowledges the urf and the ada. Al-ada muhakkama. This is a qa'ida in our fiqh, that the traditions of a people are honored as long as they don't go against the sharia. And so Ibn Qayyim, he summed up Islam in four concepts. He said Islam, all of it is rahmah, mercy. All of it is maslaha, common weal or human benefit. All of it is hikmah, wisdom, and all of it is justice. He said, so if you see something go from mercy to cruelty, from benefit to harm, from wisdom to folly, or from justice to oppression, it has nothing to do with this religion. And this is a very simple, if we can understand those four concepts and understand their opposites, this gives us a very profound and concise summary of the essence of our religion. And it's the essence that we have to get back to. Too many people are concerned with the details and they've forgotten the essence. It's like people that are more concerned about their clothes than they are about their heart. And Allah says that libasu taqwa is the best. The garment of piety is the best garment. It's not this outward garment. We adorn ourselves, and it's part of the sunnah to be concerned about how you look to others. But far more important than that is how you look to God. Allah doesn't look at our outward form. إِنَّ اللَّهَ لَا يَنْظُرُ إِلَىٰ صُوَرِكُمْ أَجْسَادِكُمْ وَصُورِكُمْ وَلَكِنُّهُ يَنْظُرُ إِلَىٰ قُلُوبِكُمْ. He looks at your hearts, not at the color of your skin. All these things. So this is just nasiha. It's the Prophet said, "Adinu nasiha." Religion is sincere advice. This is my sincere advice as a person who has traveled all over the world and seen the vast majority of Muslim countries. I've seen the almost the entire Arab world. I've seen Pakistan. I've seen Turkey. I've seen Malaysia. I've seen many places in the Muslim world, and wherever these alien ideologies have come, they have sown the seeds of dissension and fitna. And that's the last thing that you need in this time of great trial and tribulation, is more trials and tribulations. So this is my sincere advice. They got this up. So You know, we use this higher education for a higher purpose because one of the problems with modern education is they see it as a vocational training now. That the purpose of education is simply to earn a livelihood, to learn some way of making a living instead of making a life. And in the past, the purpose of education was first and foremost to learn how to make a life rather than to make a living. And our Prophet ﷺ said that one of the signs of the end of time is that people will learn for other than the sake of God. People will learn for other than the sake of God. Our religion begins with what? What's the first revelation in the Quran? What's that? What is it? Iqra? It's not Iqra. It's Iqra bismi rabbika alladhi khalaq. It's read in the name of your Lord. Everybody thinks it's Iqra. It's not Iqra. It's Iqra bismi rabbika alladhi khalaq. That's the first ayah. And so it's important for us to remember that learning is for the sake of Allah. And the Prophet ﷺ said, any momentous affair, kullu amrin dhi ba, la yabda'u bi bismillah, fahuwa abtar. Any, or bilhamd in a riwayat, bilhamd, bihamdillah, or bilhamdulillah, marfu' ala al-hikayah. Any momentous affair that does not begin in the name of Allah is cut off from blessing. One of the calamities of modern technology is that it's monetized. The sole purpose in their research and development is to make money. They don't do their research bismillah. And so much of the technology that's produced ends up being more harmful than beneficial to humanity. So it's causing all of these problems. And the restoration of knowledge for a higher purpose, for the purpose of service. Our ummah was a service ummah. One of the hadith that I believe is one of the great miracles of the Prophet is he said that one of the, in the hadith Jibreel, he said one of the signs of the end of time when Jibreel asked him, أَخْبِرْنِ عَنَ السَّاعَةِ, and he first said, I don't know any more than you do. He said, then tell me about its signs. And the Prophet ﷺ said, one of the signs was, أَنْتَلِدَ الْأَمَةُ رَبَّتَهَا, that the servant, the maidservant, gives birth to the mistress or the master. I think you can take as an ishara from that, that the Islamic civilization, which was a service civilization, it was a ummah abida, gave birth to the European civilization. But the European civilization, and this is my own, I come from, my ancestors are mostly from Ireland, I have some ancestors from Scotland, and then my mother's half Greek. But the European civilization is unfortunately a civilization of war and commerce. And Bernard Lewis said, never forget that the reason why Western civilization has attained this level of supremacy in the world is because it's learned to kill people more effectively than any other civilization in the history of human society. And this is Bernard Lewis, the great Jewish scholar, Islamic scholar of Princeton, who said this. This is not some. This is an insider, somebody who is from that civilization and knows the history. The Muslims, where they went, they built hospitals for the people. They served society. They were not belligerent by nature. They were societies that wanted commerce and trade. We had great systems of trade. The Muslims were trading with the Chinese centuries ago. We were the first globalized civilization. The Muslims knew multi-ethnic, multicultural civilization centuries ago. This is not new to Muslims. This is very new to the European mentality. They couldn't even tolerate each other that long ago. Really, they could not tolerate each other that long ago. There's some Mormons here tonight. They can tell you about the Mormon persecution not that long ago in the United States of America, because they couldn't tolerate dissension within their own Christian tradition. So the Catholics persecuted anybody that disagreed with Catholicism. They used to burn them at the stake. And then when the Protestant Reformation happened, they went to war because they couldn't stand the idea that there could be multiple ways of interpreting a tradition. But there are multiple ways. And any way that says there is only one way is the wrong way. Any way, if you hear any group telling you this is the only way Islam can be understood, that is the first red flag that they don't understand the most basic premise of Islam, which is this is a religion of mercy, and part of its mercy is difference of opinion. So it's really important that we keep that in mind. Imam al-Ghazali and the philosophers, I contend that if you do not philosophize, others will philosophize for you. If you do not think deeply about your political systems philosophically and understand what type of political philosophy you have, if you don't think deeply about what type of ethical philosophy you have, if you don't think deeply about what kind of consumer philosophy you have, because in the West, we have gratuitous consumption. We have the idea that even if you have a perfectly good iPhone, because there's a new iPhone, you throw that one out and go exchange it for the new one. Even if you have a perfectly good car, because they have a new version, you go get in debt to buy a new car. If you have perfectly good clothes, they're not in fashion anymore. The nice thing about traditional cultures, the sarang has been in fashion for the last 1,000 years, if not more. Well, Adam was probably wearing a sarang, because it's one of the oldest forms of dress in human history, right? So Muslim clothes never went out of style. They always wore the same things. The Afghans wore the same clothes. You can see pictures of Afghanis 200 years ago, drawings of Afghanis, and they're wearing the same clothes that they're wearing today, because Muslims were never fooled by this artificial construct called fashion and style. It's just a trick to sell goods that you don't need with money you don't have. So we have to restore philosophy. We have to bring it back to our tradition. Our scholars were great philosophers. Imam al-Ghazali wrote a book, Tahafat al-Falasifa, the contradictions or the incoherence of the philosophers. He wasn't talking about falsafa per se. He was talking about the type of Greek philosophy that had emerged amongst some of the Muslim intellects. And he makes a very good case of why they should reject that. So one of the things that I believe is that we're in a crisis of knowledge. This, your own philosopher, Sayyid Naqib al-Abbas, who I think is a national treasure, and I really hope that you honor him as he's moving into his twilight years. He's a national treasure. He's a true intellect. But you know, he identified this, but Imam al-Ghazali in the 6th century, he died in 505 or 504, but in the 6th century, late 5th and early 6th century, Imam al-Ghazali in the Ihya Ulum al-Din begins it with the Book of Knowledge, because he felt that the great crisis in at his time was the crisis of knowledge. Knowledge is always the crisis, which is why the only thing in the Qur'an that God tells us to ask increase for is knowledge. قُلْ رَبِّ زِدْنِي عِلْمًا. Because we always have a crisis of knowledge. It is a perennial crisis. We're always confronted with new problems that need new information, study, and knowledge to address. So my personal belief is that the liberal arts have been removed from Islamic education. The centrality of the liberal arts, which was part of our tradition, the idea of the adib, every scholar in the history of Islam of any weight was also a literary master. He was somebody who not only mastered poetry, he wrote poetry. In the Japanese tradition, and I apologize to the Malay for referring to the Japanese tradition given the history that you have, but the Japanese tradition has some great qualities, and one of the beautiful aspects of their warrior tradition, which is the samurai tradition, is that the samurai, like the yenisheri of the Turks, the samurai had to learn calligraphy, they had to learn poetry, they had to actually learn to be human as well as being warriors. And if anybody here is a fan of Akira Kurosawa, the great Japanese film director, one of the great themes of his samurai films is the humanistic centrality of the Japanese warrior. And unfortunately, that was not shown during World War II because they had lost that tradition. But the samurai were not rapists and thugs. They actually had a tradition of honor, and honor was central. And this is something that has been lost in armies today. The American army attempts, and despite the fact that there are some egregious horrible things, and I'm against bombing. I completely think that bombing is an absolutely unethical form of warfare, and it should be outlawed. That's my personal belief. But I know that within the military culture of the United States, honor is something very important to them. And traditionally, they have taken very seriously acts of rape and things in war. And when General Patton arrived in Morocco during World War II, and I read his book called My War, it's the notes of a book he wanted to write. And General Patton, who was the head of the Third Army, he met with the King of Morocco, and he said, unfortunately, with soldiers, you sometimes have dishonorable ones that will rape. I want to let Your Majesty know that if any of this happens from American soldiers, I want to be the first to know, and I promise you they will be prosecuted to the full extent of our military law. And he said that the King smiled on being told this. So traditionally, this was something... This is the military ethos of a civilized society. But when a society's civilization breaks down, you get all of these war crimes. And this is why we've had some of the most egregious war crimes in the recent wars. And we have some of these American soldiers, many of them were decent people, but some of them did the most heinous crimes against Iraqi civilians. And we know about this, and this is because they don't inculcate empathy. They don't inculcate these traditions. They teach them to become killing machines. And this is something antithetical to the spirit of jihad. The Prophet ﷺ was somebody who emphasized the importance of the humanities. He loved poetry. He listened to poetry. His favorite poet was Ibn Abi Sulth. And Omar loved poetry. All of the major Sahaba have diwans. Even Sayyidina Omar has a diwan. Abu Bakr has a diwan of poetry. They were poets. They were poet warriors. So it's very important to re-centralize the humanities within the educational institutes. The history of Zaytuna, I'm going to go into that. What is a Muslim liberal arts? And then future renovations, financial needs. So, a lot of people are confused today just about the very definition of knowledge. They're confused. Sayyidina Qibr Attas in his Prolegomena defines knowledge as the arrival of meaning to the human soul. It's meaning, it's ma'na, it's understanding. In the West, many of our universities now don't even believe in the project of meaning. If you go and study philosophy in many Western institutions, their philosophy is a nihilistic, relativistic, deconstructionist, postmodern philosophy that does not believe in meaning. And we're people that believe not only in meaning, but that words have meaning, that language can be properly understood. It has ambiguous qualities. It's not as cut and dry as the language of numbers and mathematics, but it is still, it can communicate meaning. And I wouldn't be here talking if I didn't believe that. So this is the request for increases in knowledge in the Quran. So what is our mission? We in the United States, many, and I think you probably practice this as well here, but many institutions have what are called mission statements, which is an attempt to get at the core of what you're trying to do. The mission statement of Islam is to inculcate rahmah and spread huda. This is a way of summarizing the essence of something. And so what we're trying to do is we aim to educate and prepare morally committed professionals, because leadership in America is often devoid of morality. If you go on, I know there's some Mormon guests here, if you go on to Brigham Young's website, you will see that at the essence of a Christian or a Mormon or a Catholic college in the United States is the inculcation of morality. But most of the other colleges don't even address the problem of morality. And this is why all these Harvard graduates and Princeton and Yale graduates from the best colleges in the United States could go to Wall Street and rob not only Americans, but Malaysians and Indians and Arabs and every other culture blind, and have no moral ambiguity about that problem. And it's very clear if you read some of the testimonies or listen to some of the taped conversations that came out during some of these investigations, it's quite shocking that these people had just simply no morality because they're sociopathic. They're just sick people. They don't believe in morality beyond good and evil. This is the 20th century's Nietzschean philosophy that has taken over so many people and countries. But also intellectual and spiritual, because the moral virtues are 4, the intellectual virtues are 5, and our spiritual virtues, Christian spiritual virtues, traditionally were 3, faith, hope, and charity. Our traditional virtues, according to many of our scholars, were 9. So we have intellectual virtues, we have moral virtues, and we have spiritual virtues. So a holistic education should inculcate all 3 of these, help them develop. This is the development of the human soul. But we want them grounded in the Islamic scholarly tradition, but also conversant with the cultural currents and those critical ideas that shape modern society. So they have to be relevant. They have to know the time they're living in. Sidi Ahmed Zarruq quotes a hadith about Ibrahim that at the end of, he said that, عَلَى الْمَرْءِ أَنْ يُكُونَ مُقْبِلًا عَلَى شَانِهِ مُمْسِكًا لِلِسَانِهِ عَارِفًا بِزَمَانِهِ. That a man, this was in the Suhuf of Ibrahim, a man should mind his own business, guard his tongue, because the tongue takes more people to hell than any other organ, and then to know the time that he is living in. You have to know your time. So it's very important. And many Muslims, one of the nice things about coming to Malaysia is a lot of your intellectual leadership knows about what's happening in other parts of the world. That people here, if I say postmodernism, they know what I'm talking about. But you go to other Muslim countries, and if you say Mawar al-Hadatha, they'll just look at you like, first of all, they don't know what modernity is very often, let alone post-modernity. So we have a problem. Houston. See, everybody's American now. What are the liberal arts and why do we need them? This is a true liberal arts education, by definition, equips students with tools of learning, what are called the ulum al-ala. In the Ottoman tradition, they were called al-ulum al-aliya, the instrumental arts. And then critical thinking, the ability, Imam al-Ghazali, he said, know men by the truth, don't know the truth by men. So once you've mastered the tools of learning, you should be able to assess the truth because you've learned how to reason, you've learned how to think critically. So critical thinking is extremely important. And too many of our people have lost this capacity just to have basic critical thinking skills. And then also to articulate persuasively, eloquently. This is very important. The Prophet ﷺ كان أفصح من نطق بالضاد. He was the most eloquent of those who spoke with the Arabic language. And the Qur'an, the miracle of the Qur'an has always been primarily considered to be a miracle of eloquence, of balagha, with its meanings. And so this is a very important aspect of education, is to be able to articulate your thoughts effectively. Robert Hutchins, who was the youngest dean of the University of Chicago, he was a law professor, he graduated from Yale first in his class. And when he finished Yale, he gave his commencement speech, he said, unfortunately, I didn't get an education at Yale. I learned to be a Yale man. And he wasn't being glib. He was talking about a true liberal arts education. But he went on to become educated in the liberal arts tradition and wrote a book that is still as pertinent today, and I would recommend translating it into Malay, which is his book on the crisis of higher education. It's a very important book because he identified in the 1940s, he identified the problem of sports in universities and the fact that if you have these ridiculous sports programs, they will actually detract from the learning experience. So he only allowed intramural sports at the university. He didn't allow inter-university sports. They could only play sports amongst themselves just for physical exercise. But in America, sports has become, you have these poor athletes that go to colleges that can barely read and write, that are pulled out of inner cities. And they're just there to bulk up the attendance at these massive coliseums that they build. And the Colosseum was a Roman tradition to keep the masses preoccupied. Bread and circus. pan et circus. This was the way to keep masses occupied. Sports, television, now it's violence and sexuality. These are the ways that people are, one of the interesting things about CNN this week is on the article about the Israeli land grab, right next to it was some famous actress, her computer had been hacked, and all these nude pictures of her were put up. And so if somebody's looking at the Israeli land grab and the nude pictures of this famous actress, unfortunately, most of the readers in America that are male would push the nude pictures instead of the one. And I'm wondering if Mossad hacked her computer. So the aim of a liberal education is human excellence, ihsan, both private and public. Its object is the excellence of man as man. It regards man as an end, not as a means. Many colleges now, they see the human being as a means for corporate companies to basically use you as what they call human resources. And I hope you don't use that word here in Malaysia. I hope not, because it's such a sinister word. Human beings are not resources. They're not exploitable resources. They're human beings. They're ends unto themselves. The poorest people in your society have the worth and dignity of a human being. These people serving us right now and bringing the food to our tables, they're not the means by which we feed ourselves. No, we're also their means by which they are able to take food back to their... So we serve each other. They're not means. They're ends in and of themselves. They're created by God to know their Lord and to learn the prayer. So no matter what you do in a society, you are a human being with dignity and the full rights of a human being. So that's very important to recognize human beings as ends, not as means. We are not means to somebody else's objectives. And then it regards the ends of life, not the means to it. In other words, what is the purpose of life? Why are we here? We have to think about these things. This is true education. For the reason it is the education of free men. That's why it's called liberal, because liberal means free. And this is the education of the Ahrar, the people of Hurriya, the people that are Abidullah. Because if you're the slave of God, you'll be the servant of no man. And when you do serve that man, it's for the sake of God. But you will not be his abd. You will not follow his whims and his orders. So, how are other faith communities? In America, we have Naropa as a Buddhist liberal arts college. It was founded in 1974. It has a beautiful campus. It's a liberal arts university, over 1,000 students. It was accredited in 1986. It goes all the way up to a PhD program. And the income, the yearly revenue is 25 million. This is the Buddhists who came at the same time the Muslims came in America. The Hindus have, and the Buddhists have about 9 colleges and universities in the United States. That's just the most famous, but they have others. The Hindus have 3 universities now. This is one that they have, and this is their building in Florida, Orlando. They have satellite campus in Bangalore in India. It's a Hindu liberal arts college, and it goes all the way up to PhD program also. So what does it take? Well, if you look at some of the top liberal arts colleges in the United States, and I want you to think about this. In the United States, there's about 20 million people in the United States out of a population of 300 million that are involved in post-secondary education. So this means anything beyond high school. Out of those 20 million, less than 2% are in true liberal arts colleges. And yet, the liberal arts graduates represent almost 20% of the most influential people in the United States. And we have to recognize the importance and influence of history. We've lost a tradition of history. Historians are very important in a culture. If you know the past, you can predict the future. And this is why if you look at people like Samuel Huntington, Henry Kissinger, if you look at some of the most influential political pundits in the United States, look at what they studied in their undergraduate. It's usually political science, philosophy, English literature, history. These are their subjects. And then they go on to international relations, international studies, law, ethics, philosophy. The doctors and engineers have very little influence except over your bodies. And engineers build bridges, but they don't build bridges between the minds. They build physical bridges. Philosophers build bridges between minds. So these are some of the best. Amherst, Swarthmore, Williams, Pomona. And this is what it costs per student in these excellent colleges and universities. They have very small teacher-to-student ratio, 1 to 8 usually. So here's their endowments. $1.6 billion, $1.5 billion, $1.8 billion, $1.7 billion. That's actually a highly exaggerated bar if you were doing it in relation to billions. We have 12 million, it should be a sliver. But I did it so you could read it. So we have 12 million in capital endowment, which means the buildings we own and those things. But we actually, our investment endowment is minute. So this is very important. So right now we have 58 students. The total cost per year is about $6 million. We're in the Bay Area. It's a highly, it's one of the most educated areas in the United States. In the city that we're in, there are more Nobel Prize winners per capita than any other place on the planet. This is where a lot of the technology, it has the number one engineering university's engineering department is in Berkeley. It's Lawrence Livermore is there. So the neutron bomb, unfortunately, was discovered there or invented. And the neutron bomb, by the way, was invented so that they could drop bombs on oil-producing countries and it wouldn't destroy the infrastructure. Just get rid of the humans. So that's pretty sick, if you ask me. But unfortunately, this is the way some of these scientists think that are working without calligraphy and poetry and... right? In Vietnam, your next-door neighbors, the Americans used napalm, right, which was a burning... it exploded and this gel got... So the Viet Cong, being clever people in the kampungs, they would dig a big pit of water, and then when the napalm was dropped, they would all jump in and it would get rid of the napalm so that they wouldn't burn to death. So the scientists in America devised water-resistant napalm. You see, instead of the mercy of just letting people, get rid of the burning, I mean, it's horrible. And Muslims would have never devised a weapon that killed by burning, because the Prophet said, لَا يُعَذُّبُ بِالنَّارِ إِلَّا رَبُّ النَّارِ. No one has the right to punish with fire except the Lord of fire. And that's so, there goes nuclear weapons as well. Cost per student at Zaytuna right now is about $103,000. We actually had a student that dropped out of a top liberal arts college to come to Zaytuna. And she's very happy after being at a really, really top, one of those top colleges. So by 2018, we're looking to have about 108. We want to grow slowly. We turn away far more than we actually accept in our program. The cost is going to be about $8 million, but the cost per student will go down significantly. So this is where we are right now. The Zaytuna started it with Zaytuna Institute in 1996, and so this is how we've progressed. Imam Zaid came on board and started a pilot program, and we had graduates from that program. One of them, Ibad al-Rahman, who was a teacher's aide in the program in Turkey that I came from, he's in a PhD program at Columbia University. He got a full scholarship, a very prestigious scholarship. But he went, after Zaytuna, he went to NYU, New York University, which is one of the top 5 in law in the United States now. And John Sexton, who's the president, became his teaching assistant. And he was so struck by him that when I met John Sexton, I asked if we could do a memorandum of understanding, even though we're not fully accredited yet. He said, if you're producing students like this, I'll take any of your students. So this was a you know, a testimony from I think a very a highly distinguished individual. We acquired this. This was part of a Christian college, and they ran into some difficulties, so we were fortunate to be able to buy it from them. They were very good. They actually told us about it before it went on the market, so they actually wanted us up on the hill, which is a great blessing. This, where it is called Holy Hill, because there is a consortium of religious colleges there. And we just purchased, this was literally right next door, and these buildings never come up for sale. But this is a Christian college. It's a Catholic college, the Franciscan Theological Seminary that trained priests, and they are moving to San Diego. So again, before it got on the market, we found out about it, and we were able to bid for it before it went on the market. The Chinese are now buying up property in California, and so when they go on the market, they come in with cash, and it's very hard for other people to buy, and they buy these properties very quickly. So we are fortunate to get that. No offense to any Chinese people. This is our first commencement. So we had our first graduating class. This young girl who gave the speech, the commencement speech for students, she, graduating students, she was given a summer internship at the Witherspoon Institute at Princeton, which is a Catholic institute, because of an essay that she wrote at our college that I sent to the head of the McCormick Law. He's the head of, Princeton doesn't have a chair of law, but he's the McCormick professor of law at Princeton, Robert George, who's an extremely distinguished constitutional lawyer. He's been a professor at Harvard, but he is a full professor at Princeton. And he was so impressed with the paper that she wrote that he got her an internship at Witherspoon, and she went, and they were so pleased with her, and they were really struck by, and she came to us right out of high school. So this is the level of student that has graduated from our program. She was awarded a scholarship. She's now at a MA program at the Chicago Theological Union, which is a Christian theological seminary that's over 100 years old in Chicago, where Dr. Omar Abdullah Farouk, some of you might know him, teaches. So they have an Islamic studies program there. So she's doing an MA there now. And her name's Fatima Knight, and we expect to, inshallah, see great things from her. So I think the Bachelor of Arts, we only have one program. It's called a cohort program. We don't have any electives. I'm of the educational philosophy that at the undergraduate level, they should not have electives. I don't believe in specialization for a true liberal arts education. And also students, they should be guided and directed, because a lot of students will just take the courses that they like or want to take. So the trivium is grammar, logic, and rhetoric. Islamic studies, they do very extensive studies in theology, in jurisprudence, in ethics and spirituality. And then they also, scientific literacy is very important. So they do mathematics, they do the history of science, and they do astronomy. And here's the course overview, 36 units. They do devotional and social principles of jurisprudence, theology, Quranic sciences, logic, they have a year and a half of, traditional logic. They do philosophy. Sayyidina Qibr Attas's Prolegomena is one of the books that they read. They do prophetic biography, U.S. history, ethics, comparative religion, comparative Muslim thought. And our faculty, we have 14 faculty members, many of them from some of the best universities in the United States. Dr. Delp was here with me. He gave a talk last night at the university. So these are our professors right now. Cindy Ausek and Dr. Delp are from other traditions. She has a PhD in history, and he has a PhD in medieval studies and logic. He's taught for many, many years. And then our administrative team is, we have a board of trustees, I'm the current president right now. Pauline Keyes, she has a doctorate from Exeter in England. She was a dean of a college on the East Coast for 15 years, so she's doing an incredible job. She's really helped turn around since she's come. And then Waheed Rashid came out of, he was a VP at a tech corporation. I'm going to quickly end here because I know it's getting late. But this is our haul. The purchase price was 3.6. We got it when the market had just collapsed. It's now worth close to $7 million. So we were very fortunate. We're going to renovate that. It had a church, which is going to be a lecture hall. This is the corridor, and this is the type of renovation that we'd like to do. It's got three floors, so there's a lot of space in it. So we're starting renovation this January, inshallah. And this is the second property that's right next door. It's actually a huge building with four floors. It's got really good classroom space. It's got dorms, 30 dormitory rooms for our female students. It's in a much safer area in Berkeley. And our renovation starts this October, next month. So I'm not going to, there's some brochures here that have this information. And you can go on our website, inshallah. So this is basically what we're looking for. One way that Malaysia can help, we have a program called 12,000 Strong. We're asking for $1 a day, a U.S. dollar, which would be about $30 a month from 12,000 Muslims from around the world. So if even if we could get 1,000 or 1,000 Malaysians here to be donating that, this, just like you're benefiting our institution now with books from Sayyidina Qibr Attas, from Dr. Kamali, I think Zaytuna, inshallah, will be a benefit to Malaysia in the future also. And we hope, inshallah, to have Malay students because we, inshallah, we believe we're very close to accreditation. And we're hoping for it this 2015. And once we get it full accreditation, then the State Department will issue visas to foreign students. So we're hoping that we can take Malay students next year. So I really hope that this has been beneficial, and I know it's late and I apologize for going on a little longer than I probably should have. I especially apologize to the guests a lot of people don't go to a lot of lectures, but when you're in public life, you go to a lot of lectures, and so I think it's always the hadith they wish was implemented, khairul kalam ma qalla wa dalla, the best of speech is what's quick and to the point. So thank you very much.